Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Tom Grasser of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Kenosha, Wisconsin. We heard him share that he lost his mother in a car accident as a young boy and that he had never learned to drive until the Army made him an ambulance driver. You're not going to believe the incredible coincidence with his ambulance. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But let's hear now about his first real taste of the war when he landed in France.
We came in on the Omaha Beach. Of course, we had to waterproof our ambulances. We put tape on the door so water wouldn't come in. And the carburetor and differential, they had a gauze material that was had beeswax or something on it. This was to keep the water from getting into the carburetor because you come off an LST and you're in the water.
Right.
And I don't know much about mechanics, but we did cover the carburetor and the distributor and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, landing craft came in. It hit the beach at LST. The doors had opened, and then the ramp went down. And the engineers had been there long enough by the time we went over there that they'd put grates under it. So you come off with your front wheels digging, well,
right.
You go right in, and you couldn't get traction. Anyhow, they were able to beach them high enough and get in there. And it was like a big balloon floating, coming in until we got on terra firma. We're in a field. They said, park your cars, their vehicles over there. And they said, it hasn't been checked for landmines yet. So the lieutenant of the 1st Platoon got in a truck, and he drove across the field one way, then the other way, and then angled. And, of course, fortunately, there's no landmine, so we pulled all in there. And then when they got a convoy to go to the front. And that evening, while we were heading out, and we got to Avranches, and apparently there was a bridge there. The vehicles were all backed up, and it got dark. And the airplane comes over and drops a flare, several flares. And, of course, I sit on the bumper, a dumb kid, bumper of the ambulance, and said to my buddy, I said, hey, they're taking pictures of us. All of a sudden, two Stukas, and they had a whistle on the tail, a screamer, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come, and I'd make the hair in the back of your head stand up. And anyhow, they came screaming along, and they're bombing and strafing. And Boy Scouts honor, they came to those 30 ambulances that were bumper to bumper. They pulled up, did not drop a bomb or strafe, and then continued strafing. Came around, did it again. And that was when the Germans respected the Red Cross. If it wasn't for that, several of us have been gone the first night on. And funny thing, we went to a bivouac area, and the next morning a guy comes shooting up in a Jeep, and he says, I'm a priest, I'm going to say Mass. Anyone here serve? And of course I was able to serve Mass. First day I was on the continent on the hood of a Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And figured I had me a good guardian angel. And to this day, and I'm going to give you one, I got a guardian angel for you. I'm not the best, I'm no angel by no manner of means, and I'm not the best Christian in the world, but I've got angels that have saved my butt. And who'd ever thought that?
Mm-hmm.
I'd hit 91 years of age. I'm a very rich man.
And going strong. I've got to ask you, that circumstance, and again, thinking about how young you are, I mean, you're probably approaching at that point your 20th birthday. It's
yes.
it's 1944, and this is your first taste of combat, and these dive bombers come in, and they're hitting everything around you, and they pause because of the Red Cross. Does that tell you, man, I'm really lucky to still be here, or does it say, uh-oh, I'm going to be in danger the rest of the time I'm over here?
No, that's going back. That's a long way. But I felt that they respected it. I later found out that as we followed the 4th and the 5th Armored most of the time over there, found out that we carried more Germans back to our hospitals than we did GIs.
Mm.
And when we hit the bulge and places like that, we were bringing back GIs. And then we knew we were taking it in the shorts.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the reason they have guys that don't fire guns and they or medics or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
They kept us alive for some reason, and it paid off for a lot of German people who were saved as well.
Well, and that's an important distinction for people to hear, that when you're over there and you've got that Red Cross on the side of your ambulance and probably on the side of your helmet too, that even though you're wearing the colors of the United States, a life is a life.
Yep.
Was it any different for you when you were caring for a wounded enemy soldier?
No, not really. You know, those guys, I think, and that's just my opinion, they're fighting for their country just like we were. The politics they had over there may not have been right, you know, but they're trying to get home to their families, and they're fighting for the country. And I tell you, the hardest thing that bothers me, when we came to Dachau, they thought we were a bunch of Germans in GI uniforms, and the gates, of course, all the guards taken off, and they had to go through the gates with the tranks. And of course, then we came through in our turn. And a lot of the people had been killed, but a lot of them were still standing there. You know, they just couldn't kill them all or didn't. And for that reason, I'm real proud that I was a medic, because we did some good. Some good came out of a bad situation.
And I realize chronologically we're probably going to be bouncing around here a little bit, but since we're on the topic of Dachau, can you help us understand what you saw there? Because so few people in the history of the world actually witnessed that in person, and there are people that say it never happened. But you were there, you saw the people, you saw the shape they were in. What did you see?
I tell you, there were sheds on the side of the, with bodies in, that were just stacked high. They put, I guess, lye or whatever it was on them. But the people, you could see their joints had been starved, and it was just like so much cordwood piled up. And to see the conditions that they lived under, they were like in barns, and they had shelves with straw on. The people that we took out of there, prisoners that, you know, they just didn't kill them all.
And you witnessed similar things at the Buchenwald concentration camp.
They had big trenches that they dig with bulldozers, and they'd machine gun them there or put them through the ovens. I can't tell you exactly everything, but it's if I live to be 100 years old, that is the worst memory that I have. And to think another person would do this, it's unbelievable. And somebody says it didn't happen, by God, it did. It's just...
I think we all understand why it can make you emotional. And the bottom line is, it would have happened to millions more if you guys weren't there to put an end to it. If America didn't stand up the way it did. Did that give you some satisfaction to know that you were part of saving the people who didn't have to suffer that fate?
You know, it does. And still does. The history, I'm not a historian or anything, but people that will say things like that didn't happen. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of us left, but it's going on every day, mm-hmm. even to this day. Mm-hmm. And we figured that was the war to end all wars. It didn't stop a thing, hardly. I don't know. I'm no authority. But I tell you, war is, pardon the expression, is hell. Your sons and daughters and your mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles that were in that thing gave a lot, and they need to be remembered and prayed for. And just... we can never thank them enough.
Amen. Well, you just hammered home exactly why this program exists, and I hope that's what we're doing today. And I don't want to make you dwell on the concentration camp issue, but I do have one question. Because as you go in there, and you're part of this liberating force, and you're evacuating people who've been emaciated, who've been tortured, who were very near death, had you had any idea before that these places existed, or was this a complete shock to your system?
Complete shock. We had no idea. We didn't see the news or anything. You know, we were just doing what we, you know, going along. And to run into that was, like I say, it's just indelibly marked in my memory. The worst thing of the whole war was to see what they did to
people
that were completely helpless, could not defend themselves.
Mm-hmm. On the day-to-day, as an ambulance driver, I mean, on one hand, as I try to imagine being in your shoes, in a war that's claiming so many lives, you get to be a part of saving lives. But at the same time, you probably came face-to-face with a lot of guys you could do nothing for.
Yeah.
What was it like on a day-to-day basis, and what kind of kept you going?
It's a tough one. I think the thinking, and I'm only speaking for myself, was that this was something that we did not start. We were trying to stop it. Every day it becomes routine. You may not like it, but it's what it is. Do your job the best you can. We felt we were right and we were doing the right thing. After it's all over, I know we're doing the right thing. But you get just so that you're not accustomed to it, but it is what it is, and it isn't going to change.
You told us about that first night and the Stukas coming in and how close of a call that was. We can all feel that. I imagine that wasn't the only time, though, that you look back and you feel like one of those guardian angels was there with you.
Yeah. I tell you, looking at this Jeep in front of us right here.
Yeah.
When we went in there, they used to drive with the windshield down and open like that. And they used to string piano wire between the trees. They'd cut a person's head off just. So what we did, the motor pool had angle iron that would come up high enough to over your head. And then they had a hook hanging down, another piece of angle iron. So if you hit the piano wire, it'd cut it. And one time, Earl was driving and I was just sitting there. It was night and we were trying to get back to where we were supposed to be. And we heard a poing. We hit a piano wire, and I said, Johnson, I don't think we're supposed to be here. We turned around, and we barreled out of there. And I do believe that a lot of the soldiers did not shoot at the ambulances or Red Cross. I think they respected it. I could be wrong.
I've talked to a lot of guys, and my grandfather was actually in the Medical Corps in Europe.
Oh,
he was at the Bulge, and he had an incident where he got the Silver Star, and he kept going in and pulling guys out, pulled 26 guys out of burning tanks, and they told him afterwards that they weren't shooting at him because of the Red Cross. He wasn't quite sure he believed it. But I've had some other people that were actually targeted at different times, especially in infantry situations. Some of the medics were targeted. So it wasn't always a fail-safe, but it helped you get through.
Yeah. I tell you, early in the war, they used to take the clothes off the guys when they, you know, put them in to work on them and patch them up and all. And there was just piled clothes outside the tent and helmets and, you know, whatever, pistol belts and all. And this one helmet had a Red Cross on it. And we used to have circles on
around.
And it was right through the middle of the doggone. And that guy blew his head off, I'm sure. We took our Red Crosses off of the helmets.
That was a pretty good warning you got by saying that. Wow.
Now, whether everybody did it or not, I don't know. But we did.
I don't blame you. I know this isn't easy to talk about, but I'm sure there were scores of wounded soldiers that you dealt with. Some who made it, some who didn't, different degrees of injuries. Not to be gory, but just so we understand, can you give us a sense of the kind of shape that you saw people in and how difficult that was to see them dealing with it?
We had two hospitals there that were side by side, small ones, what they called a field hospital. And the regular evac hospital was where they did the sewing up and sending them. The field hospital was where the people had come out of there that had head wounds or gut wounds could not be moved out, and they'd keep them there. When they broke camp to move on to the next place, if there were any people in there that couldn't be evacuated, one ambulance would stay behind. And I remember in Pearl, Luxembourg, our ambulance was chosen to stay behind. And I think we were there for about a week after the other guys had moved out. The people in the little farm village, just one winding road through, farmers, the lady had us up in the attic of the house. And every night we had, if you can believe it, down comforters. And they made, our beds were up there. We had, you know, sleeping bags. Well, we didn't need to use them there. And she'd come up at night and they'd had a little water. It looked like the old lunch boxes we used to have when we were kids, kind of a hole in the top and they'd fill it with water. And they put it on the stove or by the fireplace. And she'd move it around in the bed. When we came back at night, we had a warm bed to sleep in. But we were staying behind because they had two guys that could not be moved. It would have killed them. They were always attached to the evac hospital, and they called it a field hospital.
And was there ever anything, I don't know, maybe there's nothing you can do, but besides the medical care and bandaging guys up and making sure they have all that, and you have a team of people that are working on that, was there ever any emotional or even conversational comfort that you could help provide for any of these guys? Did you ever find a way to help console them?
No, we didn't do that. We just brought them in and dropped them off, and then we'd go back because we figured we'd get back, we'd be able to get some sleep. Well, if it was in a bad time, we'd turn around. One guy'd drive and one guy'd sleep. And I remember at the evac hospitals, they had a little tent on the side where we could get, they had bread and coffee and the Spam. And people say that they got sick of Spam in World War II. It's the best steak I ever had. We used to cut off chunks real like that. It was a big long tube about that big and just whack it off, put it in between two slices of bread. And we had pockets on there. Fatigues. Fill them up with that, get a canteen full of coffee and take off. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that was one of the things that I remember to this day, I still love.
It's all about perspective, right? Tom Grasser is our guest today, and the best is yet to come. Don't forget to take a look at the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You're also going to find video of Tom with the old friend he hadn't seen in more than 70 years. It's not a person, but it does have a name, and he'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV Country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly-and-buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.